This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The astrolabe had been released and was now moored 150 meters away, guarded by a constable who kept himself warm pacing up and down the towpath. It was an old barge without a motor, a stable boat, as they called these barges that travel along canals with their horses on board. Passing cyclists turned to stare at this grayish hull, about which all the papers have been talking for the past 2 days. As usual, when Superintendent Maigret had been brought in, it was because there were no fresh clues to be noted. Everybody had gone into the case, and the witnesses had already been questioned 50 times, first by the local gendarmerie, then by the Corbeil police, by magistrates, and by reporters. "You'll see it was Emile Gradué who committed the crime," he had been told. And Maigret, after spending 2 hours questioning Gradué, was back on the scene of the incident, his hands in the pockets of his heavy overcoat, looking cross and staring at the gloomy landscape as though he was considering buying a plot of land there. The interest lay not in the lock at Cordray into which the barge had crashed, but at the other end of the reach, 8 kilometers higher, upstream at the lock of La Citanguette. The setting here was much the same as lower down. The villages of Morsang and Saint-Paul were on the opposite bank, a longish way off, so that there was nothing to be seen but the quiet water with copses beside it and the occasional scar of an old gravel pit. But at La Cinquanguette, there was a bistro, and boats did their utmost to spend the night there. It was a real boatman's bistro, where they sold bread, canned goods, sausage, tackle, and oats for the horses. And that was really where Maigret conducted his inquiry, without appearing to do so, taking a drink from time to time, sitting down by the stove, or taking a turn outside, while the patron, who was so fair as to be almost an albino, watched him with a slightly ironical respect. About that Wednesday evening, the following facts were known. When it was beginning to get dark, the Aiglon set, a small tug from the upper Seine, had brought her 6 lighters, like a brood of ducklings, up the Citanguette lock. It was drizzling at the time. When the boats were moored, the men foregathered as usual in the bistro for a drink, while the lock keeper took in his cranks. The astrolabe came round the river bend only half an hour later, by which time darkness had fallen. Old Arthur Ertz, the skipper, was at the wheel, while Clausens walked along the towpath in front of his horses, with his whip over his shoulder. Then the astrolabe had moored behind the string of boats, and Clausens had taken his horses on board. At that point, nobody had paid attention to them. It was 7 o'clock at least, and everyone had finished eating, when Ayres and Clausens came into the bistro and sat down by the stove. The skipper of Aiglon Set was doing most of the talking, and the 2 old men did not speak. The white-haired patron, with a baby in her arms, served them with 4 or 5 glasses of Marc, but she had taken little notice of them. That was how it had been, Maigret now realized. All these people were more or less acquainted with one another. They would come in with a brief gesture of greeting and sit down without a word. Sometimes a woman would come in, just to buy provisions for next day, and then to warn her husband as he sat there drinking, "Don't be too late back." That had been the case with Ayres' wife, Emma, who had brought bread, eggs, and a rabbit. From that point onwards, every detail acquired crucial importance. Every piece of evidence became extremely valuable, and so Maigret persisted. "You're sure that when he left about 10 o'clock, Arthur Ertz was drunk?" "Quite tight, as usual," the proprietress replied. "He was a Belgian, a good fellow on the whole, who always sat in his corner saying nothing and went on drinking till he just got strength enough left to go back to his boat." "And Clausens, the carter?" "He could take a bit more. He stayed about 1/4 hour longer. Then he went off, after coming back for his whip, which he'd forgotten." So far, so good. It was easy to picture the banks of the Seine at night, below the lock, the tug with its 6 lighters behind it, then Ayert's barge, with a lamp hanging over each boat, and the steady drizzle pouring down over it all. About 9:30, Emma had gone back on board the barge with her provisions. At 10, Aerts had gone back himself, quite tight, as the patron had said. And at 5:15, the carter had at last made his way back to the Astrolabe. I was only waiting for him to leave to close down, because boatmen go to bed early and there was nobody else left. So much was reliable evidence and could be confirmed. But it was all. After that, not the smallest piece of exact information. At 6 a.m, the skipper of the tug had been surprised not to see the Astrolabe behind his lighters, and a little later, he had noticed that the moorings had been cut. At the same moment, the lock keeper at Le Cordray, who was looking after his sick wife, had heard the shouts of the old carter, and soon afterwards had discovered that the barge had run into his weir. The dog was running loose on the deck. The carter, woken up by the collision, knew nothing, and declared that he had been asleep all night in his stable, as usual. Only, in the cabin at the back of the boat, Ayert's body was discovered. He had been hanged, not with a rope, but with the dog's chain. Then behind a curtain that concealed the wash basin, his wife Emma was found hanging too. She had been hanged with a sheet taken from the bed. And that was not all, since just before setting forth, the skipper of the Aillon Sept, after vainly calling for his stoker, Emile Gradu, discovered that the man had disappeared. Gradu was the murderer. Everybody was convinced of it. And that very evening, the newspapers were full of such headlines as Gradu seen prowling around Saint-Port, Manhunt in Forest of Rougol, Aort's hoard still not found. For all evidence went to prove that old Aerts had had a hoard, and indeed everyone agreed on the sum, 100,000 francs. It was a long, yet quite simple story. Aerts, who was 60 and had 2 grown-up married sons, had married, as his second wife, Emma, a tough Strasbourgeoisie, 20 years his junior. Things were not going at all well between the couple. At every lock they stopped, Emma would grumble about the miserliness of the old man who scarcely gave her enough to eat. "I don't even know where he keeps his money," she would say. "He wants his sons to have it when he dies, and meanwhile I have to kill myself looking after him and steering the boat, not to mention," she would add crude details, sometimes in front of Aerts himself. Well, he just shook his head stubbornly. Then after she had left, he would mutter, "She only married me for my 100,000 francs, but she's going to be disappointed." Emma would comment furthermore, as though his sons needed it to live on. In fact, the elder son, Joseph, was a skipper of a tugboat at Antwerp, while Theodore, with his father's help, had brought a fine self-propelled barge, the Marie France. He had been notified of his father's death while passing through the Maastricht in Holland. "But I'm going to find those 100,000 francs of his," she would tell you all this out of the blue, when she'd only known you 5 minutes, giving the most intimate details about her old husband and adding cynically, "He surely can't suppose that it was out of love that a young woman like myself," and she was unfaithful to him. The evidence was indisputable. Even the skipper of the Aillon Sept knew about it. I can only tell you what I know. But it's a fact that during the fortnight we were lying idle at Alfortville and the Astrolabe was being loaded, Emile Gradu often went to meet her, even in broad daylight. So what next? Emile Gradu, 23 years of age, was a bad character. That was obvious. He had, in fact, been caught after 24 hours, half-starved, in the forest of Rougol, less than 5 kilometers from La Citanguette. "I've done nothing!" he yelled at the policeman as he tried to ward off their blows. A nasty little ruffian with whom Maigret had been closeted for 2 hours in his office and who kept stubbornly repeating, "I've done nothing." "Then why did you run away?" "That's my business." As for the examining magistrate, convinced that Gradu had hidden the hoard in the forest, he had fresh searches made there in vain. There was something infinitely dreary about it all. As dreary as the river which reflected the same sky from morning till night, or those strings of boats that announced their arrival with a blast from a hooter, one blast for each barge being towed, as they threaded their way into the lock in an endless stream. Then, while the women stayed on deck to look after the children and keep an eye on the movements of the boat, the men went up to the bistro for a drink and then walked slowly back. "It's plain sailing," one of his colleagues had said to Maigret. And yet Maigret, as sullen as the Seine itself, as sullen as a canal in the rain, had returned to his lock and could not bring himself to leave it. "It's always the same story. When a case seems too clear-cut, nobody bothers to probe it in detail. Everybody agreed that Gradu was criminal, and he had such a villainous look about him that it seemed self-evident. Nonetheless, the result of the post-mortem had now come in, and they led to some curious conclusions. Thus, in the case of Arthur Aerts, Dr. Paul said, slight bruising at the base of the chin. From the state of rigor mortis and the contents of the stomach, it can be specified that death by strangulation occurred between 10 and 10:30 p.m. Now, Aerts had gone back on board at 10 o'clock. According to the white-haired patron, Claciens had followed him a quarter of an hour later, and Claciens declared that he had gone straight into his cabin. Was there a light in the Aerts' cabin? I don't know. Was the dog tied up? The poor fellow had thought for a long time, but had finally made a helpless gesture. No, he didn't know. He hadn't noticed. How could he have foretold that it would matter so much what he did that particular evening? He had been drowsy with drink as usual. He slept in his clothes on the straw, lying cozily beside his horse and his mare. You heard no noise? He didn't know. He couldn't have known. He had gone to sleep. And when he woke up, he had found himself in midstream, up against the weir. At this point, however, there was a piece of evidence. But could it be taken seriously? It came from Madame Cotier, the wife of the skipper of the Alliancette. The head of the Corbeil police had questioned her, like everyone else, before letting the train of boats carry on its journey toward the Long Canal. Maigret had the report in his pocket. Did you hear anything during the night? Answer. I couldn't swear to it. Question. Tell us what you heard. Answer. It's so uncertain. I woke up at one point and looked at the time on my alarm clock. It was a quarter to 11. I thought I heard people speaking near the boat. Question. Did you recognize the voices? Answer. No. But I thought it must be Gradu meeting Emma. I must have fallen asleep immediately after. Could one rely on this? And even if it was true, what did it prove? Below the lock, the tugboat and its six lighters and the astrolabe had been lying quiet that night. And, as regards Ayer, the report was definite. He had died of strangulation between 10 and 10:30 p.m. But things became more complicated when it came to the second report, the one about Emma. It reads, the left cheek shows contusions produced either by a blunt instrument or by a violent blow with someone's fist. Death, due to asphyxia by hanging, must have taken place at about 1 a.m. And Maigret became ever more deeply absorbed in the slow, ponderous life of La Citanguette, as though only there was he capable of thought. A self-propelled barge flying a Belgian flag reminded him of Theodore, Aerts' son, who must by now have reached Paris. And at the same time, the Belgian flag suggested the thought of gin. For on the table in the cabin, there had been found a bottle of gin, more than half empty. Somebody had made a thorough search of the cabin itself, and even tore open the mattress covers, scattering the flock stuffing, obviously in an attempt to find the hidden hoard of 100,000 francs. The first investigators had declared, it's quite simple. Emile Gradu killed Aerts and Emma. Then he got drunk and hunted for the treasure, which he hid in the forest. Only Dr. Paul, in his post-mortem on Emma's body, had found in her stomach all the gin that was missing from the bottle. Clearly, since Emma had drunk the gin, it couldn't have been Gradu. Sure, the investigators had replied. Gradu, after killing Aerts, had made the woman tipsy in order to overcome her more easily. for she was a strong creature, don't forget. So that if they were right, Gradu and his mistress must have stayed on board from 10 or 10:30 p.m., the time of Eyert's death, until midnight or 1 a.m., the time of Emma's. It was possible, of course. Everything was possible. Only Maigret wanted, somehow or other, to get to understand the Bargee's way of thinking. He had been as harsh as the rest with Emile Gradu. For 2 hours, he had grilled him thoroughly. To begin with, he had tried the wheedling method, la chansonnette, as they said at the Quai des Orfèvres. Listen, old fellow, you're involved, that's clear. But to be frank with you, I don't believe you killed the pair of them. I've done nothing. You didn't kill them, that's for sure. But admit that you knocked the old fellow about a bit. It was his own fault, of course. He caught you together, and so in self-defense, I've done nothing. As for Emma, of course you didn't touch her, since she was your woman. You're wasting your time. I've done nothing. Afterwards, Maigret had become harsher, even threatening. Oh, so that's how it is. Well, we shall see if once you're on that boat with the two bodies. But Gradu had not even flinched at the prospect of a reconstruction of the crime. Whenever you like, I've done nothing. All the same, when we find the money you've put away somewhere, then Emile Gradu gave a smile of pity, an infinitely superior smile. That evening, the only vessels moored at La Citanguette were one motorized barge and a stable boat. By the lower lock, a policeman was still on duty, on the deck of the Astrolabe, and he was greatly surprised when Maigret, climbing up on board, announced, "I haven't time to go back to Paris. I shall sleep here." The soft lapping of water could be heard against the hull, and the footsteps of the policeman as he paced the deck for fear of going to sleep. The poor man began to wonder whether Maigret was not going out of his mind, for he was making as much noise all alone inside the boat as if the two horses had been let loose in the hold. "Excuse me, officer," Maigret emerged from the hatchway. "Could you possibly get hold of a pickaxe for me?" Get hold of a pickaxe at 10 o'clock at night in such a spot? However, the policeman woke up the sad-looking lockkeeper, who, being a gardener, owned a pickaxe. "What does your super want to do with it?" "Blessed if I know." And they exchanged significant glances. As for Maigret, he went back into the cabin with his pickaxe, and for an hour after that, the policeman heard muffled blows. "Look here, officer." It was Maigret again, sweating and out of breath, thrusting his head through the hatchway. "Go and put through a phone call for me. I'd like the examining magistrate to come as early as possible tomorrow morning, and have Emile Gradu brought along." The lockkeeper had never looked so lugubrious as when he guided the examining magistrate to the barge, while Gradu followed, flanked by a couple of policemen. "No, I swear I don't know anything." Maigret was asleep on the Eyert's bed. He did not even apologize, and seemed unaware of the magistrate's stupefaction at the sight of the cabin. The floorboards had been lifted. Underneath, there was a layer of cement, but this had been smashed with the pickaxe, and the mess was indescribable. "Come in, Monsieur le Juge. I was very late getting to bed, and I hadn't had time to tidy myself up yet." He lit a pipe. He had found some bottles of beer somewhere, and he poured himself a drink. "Come in, Gradu. And now?" "Yes, now?" asked the magistrate. "It's quite simple," Maigret declared, puffing at his pipe. "I'll explain to you what happened the other night. You see, there was one thing that struck me from the first. Old Eyert had been hanged with a chain, and his wife with a sheet. You'll soon understand. Study police records, and I'll swear you'll never find a single case of a man hanging himself with a wire or a chain. It may be odd, but it's so. Suicides are sensitive people, and the thought of those links bruising their throat and pinching the skin of their necks, so Arthur Eyert was murdered? That's my conclusion, yes. And particularly since the bruise that was noticed on his chin seems to prove that the chain, having been slipped around his neck from behind while he was drunk, struck his face first. I don't see... Wait a minute! Now note that his wife, on the other hand, had been hanged with a twisted sheet. Not even a rope, whereas there are plenty of them on board a boat. No, a sheet off a bed, which is the gentlest way of hanging oneself, so to speak. And that means... that she hanged herself. She even had to swallow half a liter of gin to get up the courage, whereas normally she never drank. Remember the forensic report? I remember it. So we have one murder and one suicide. The murder committed at about 10:15, the suicide at midnight or 1 a.m. And that makes everything as clear as daylight. The magistrate was watching him somewhat suspiciously, and Emile Gradu with ironical curiosity. For a long time now, McGray went on, Emma, who had not got what she hoped for from her marriage to old Aerts, and who was in love with Emile Gradu, had been obsessed by one idea, to get hold of the hoard and run away with her lover. Suddenly an opportunity arose. Aerts came home dead drunk. Gradu was close by, on board the tug. She'd already noticed, when she went to buy her provisions in the bistro, that her husband was pretty tipsy. So she unfastened the dog and waited, with the chain all ready to be slipped around the man's neck. But, the magistrate objected, presently let me finish. Now Aerts is dead. Emma, elated with her triumph, runs to fetch Gradu. Don't forget, at this point, that the wife of the tugboat skipper had heard voices close to her boat at 10:45. Isn't that true, Gradu? It's true. The couple come on board to look for the treasure. Search everywhere, even inside the mattress, but fail to find those 100,000 francs. Is that true, Gradu? It's true. Time passes, and Gradu grows impatient. He even wonders, I'd be willing to bet, if he's not been had, if those 100,000 francs really exist. Emma swears they do, but what use are they if they can't be found? So they keep on searching. Then Gradu gets fed up. He knows he'll be accused of the crime. He wants to clear off. Emma wants to go with him. Excuse me, the magistrate tried to put in. Presently, I'll tell you, she wants to go off with him. And since he has no desire to be burdened with a woman who hasn't even any money, he solves the problem by knocking her out with his fist. Having floored her, he cuts the moorings of the barge. Is that true, Gradu? This time, Gradu seemed reluctant to reply. That's about all, Maigret concluded. If they had discovered the treasure, they'd have gone off together, or else they'd have tried to make the old man's death look like suicide. Since they failed to find it, Gradu takes fright and roams through the countryside trying to take cover. Emma, when she comes around, finds the boat drifting downstream and the hanged man swinging by her side. No hope left for her, not even the hope of escape. It would mean waking Clausens to guide the barge with the boat hook. In short, the whole thing has been a fiasco, and she decides to kill herself. Only as her courage fails her, she drinks first, and then takes a soft sheet from the bed. Is this true, Gradu? Asks the magistrate, watching the young thug. Since the super says so, but wait a minute, the magistrate objected. What is to prove that he didn't find the treasure, and in order to keep it? Then Maigret merely kicked aside some pieces of cement and disclosed a hiding place in which lay Belgian and French gold coins. Do you understand now? More or less, the magistrate muttered without much conviction. And Maigret, filling a fresh pipe, growled, One had to know, in the first place, that they use a cement foundation for repairing old barges. Nobody had told me that. Then, with a sudden change of tone, The oddest thing about it is that I've counted, and there really are 100,000 francs. A peculiar household, don't you think?
You've been listening to Two Corpses on a Barge, a Inspector Maigret mystery by George Simenon. It was read to us this evening by Professor Ginger Kitty. She was in town a while back. We hope to have her back again here on Gremlin Time. This is for Tenado. We have another story this evening. Things came up a little short with this. We're going to present a train story now, our second story for this evening, featuring Aubergine Plum, Payne's Gray, Woody Creek, and myself, Fortunato. So listen now to the night run of the Overland.
It snowed. The switch lamps at Valley Junction twinkled faintly through the swirling flakes. A broad band of light from the night operator's room shot out into the gloom, and it too was thickly powdered. Aside from this, the scattered houses of the little hamlet slept in darkness, all save one. Through the drawn curtains of a cottage which squatted in the right angle formed by the intersecting tracks 100 yards or more from the station, a light shone dully. Inside, a young woman with a book in her lap sat beside a sick bed. On the bed lay a young man of perhaps 30. They were not an ordinary couple, nor of the type which prevailed in Valley Junction. The rugged strength of the man, which shone through even the pallor of sickness, was touched and softened by an unmistakable gentleness of birth, and the dark eyes which rested motionless upon the further wall were thoughtful and liquid with intelligence. The young woman was yet more striking. Her loose gown, girdled at the waist with a tasseled cord, only half concealed the sturdy, sweeping lines of the form beneath. Her placid, womanly face was crowned with a glorious mass of burnished auburn hair. Her blue eyes, now fixed solicitously upon her husband's face, were dark with what seemed to be an habitual earnestness of purpose, and her sweet mouth drooped seriously. After a moment, though, she shook off her pensive mood.
"What are you thinking of, dear?"
she asked with a brightening face.
"Of you,"
answered her husband gravely, tightening his grasp upon the hand she had slipped into his.
"Comparing your life in this wretched place, Sylvia, with what it was before I married you, and thinking of that wonderful thing called love, which can make you content with the change."
The young woman bent forward with a little spasmodic movement and laid her beautiful hair upon the pillow beside her husband's dark strands. For a little she held herself in a kind of breathless tension, her hand upon his further temple, her full, passionate lips pressed tight against his cheek.
"Not content, my heart's husband, but happy."
After a moment she lifted herself and quietly smoothed her ruffled hair.
"I mustn't do that again,"
she said demurely.
"The doctor said you were not to be excited. I guess I won't allow you to think any more on that subject either,"
she added with pretty tyranny.
"Only this, Ben. Papa will forgive us someday. He's good. Just give him some time. Someday you'll put away your dear foolish pride and let me write to him and tell him where we are, no matter if he did forbid it. And he'll write back, take my word for it, and say, 'Come home, children, and be forgiven.' But whether he does or not, I tell you, sweetheart, I would sooner flutter about this little dovecot of ours and ride on the engine with you on bright days than be the mistress of the finest palace Papa's money could buy."
For a moment the pair looked the love they could not speak. Then the spell was broken by the distant scream of a locomotive, half drowned in the howling wind. Sylvia glanced at the clock.
"There's the Overland. She's 3 minutes late. The wind is dead against her. Someday, dear, if you want to, you will hold the throttle of that engine, and I shall be the proudest girl in the land."
With a fine unconscious loyalty to the corporation which gave them bread and butter, they listened in silence to the dull roar of the incoming train. But instead, a moment later, of the usual thunderous burst as the train swept by and the trembling of earth, they heard the grinding of brake shoes, the whistle of the air, and then, in the lull which followed, the thumping of a pump like some great, excited heart. At this unexampled occurrence, the sick man threw his wife a startled glance, and she sprang to the front window and drew back the curtain. She was just turning away again, still unsatisfied, when there came a quick, imperative rap at the door. Instantly connecting this rap with the delayed train, Sylvia flung the door wide open, revealing 3 men, the foremost of whom she recognized as the night operator at the junction.
"Mrs. Fox, this is the general superintendent, Mr.—"
"My name is Howard, madam,"
said the official for himself, unceremoniously pushing forward.
"We're in trouble. Our engineer had a stroke of apoplexy 15 miles back, and I want your husband to take this train. I know he's sick, but—"
"But he's too sick, sir, to hold his head up."
"What's the trouble?"
called Fox sharply from his bed. An instant's hush fell over the little group at the door. and then they all, as if moved by one impulse, filed quickly back to the sick room.
Mr. Fox, I hate to ask a sick man to get out of bed and pull a train, but we're tied up here hard and fast with not another engineer in sight, and every minute that train stands there, the company loses $1,000. If you can pull her through to Stockton, it'll be the best 2 hours' work that you ever did. I will give you $500.
Fox had at first risen to his elbow, but now he sank back, dizzy and trembling from weakness. In a moment, though, he was up again.
I can't do it, Mr. Howard. I'm too sick. If it weren't a physical impossibility, if I weren't too dizzy to hold my head up.
He broke off abruptly and pressed his hand in a dazed way to his brow. Then he fixed his excited eyes upon his wife. The other men followed his gaze, plainly regarding him as out of his head. But Sylvia turned pale and leaned against the wall for support. She had caught her husband's meaning.
She'll take the train, sir. And she'll take it through safe. She knows an engine as well as I. And every inch of the road. Sylvia, you must go. It is your duty.
The superintendent, staggered at this amazing proposition,
what?
Gasped and stared at the young woman.
I don't know.
She stood with her dilated eyes fastened upon her husband, her chest rising and falling, and blood-red tongues of returning color shooting through her cheeks. Yet even in that crucial moment, when her little heart was fluttering like a wounded bird, something in Sylvia's eye, something hard and stubborn, fixed the skeptical superintendent's attention, and he drew a step nearer.
Well...
Sylvia, with twitching nostrils and swelling throat, turned upon him almost desperately.
I will go,
she said in a low, resigned voice.
But someone must stay here with him.
This young man will attend to all that, never fret,
cried Howard gaily in his relief, turning to the night operator.
Don't worry about a thing, ma'am. I'll look after him.
Whatever doubts the superintendent may have harbored yet of the fair engineer's nerve and skill were plainly removed when Sylvia returned from an inner room after an absence of scarcely 60 seconds.
Well, I'll be...
An indomitable courage was stamped upon her handsome features, and she bore herself with the firm, subdued mien of one who knows the gravity of her task, yet has faith in herself for its performance. One of her husband's caps was drawn tightly over her thick hair. She had slipped into a short walking skirt, and as she advanced, she calmly but swiftly buttoned her jacket. Without hesitation, she stepped to the bedside and kissed her husband.
Be brave, girl. You've got to make 75 miles an hour, or better. But you've got the machine to do it with. Give her her head on all the grades except 4 Mile Creek. Don't be afraid, and give her a little sand on Beechtree Hill. Goodbye, and God keep you.
As Sylvia stood beneath the great black hulk of iron and steel which drew the overland, compared with which her husband's little local engine was but a toy, and glanced down the long line of mail, express, and sleeping cars laden with human freight, her heart almost failed her again. The mighty boiler towered high above her in the darkness like the body of some horrible antediluvian monster, and the steam rushed angrily from the dome as though the great animal were fretting under an unaccountable delay, and longed to be off again on the wings of the wind, rending the tempest with its iron snout and awakening the sleeping hills and hollows with its hoarse shriek.
You're a brave little woman,
she heard the superintendent saying at the cab step.
Don't lose your nerve, but make time. Whatever else you do, every minute you make up is money in the company's pocket, and they won't forget it. Besides, we've got a big gun on board. And I want you to show him that a little thing like this don't frustrate us any. If you draw into Stockton on time, I'll add $500 to that check. Remember that.
And he lifted her up to the cab. The fireman, a young Irishman, stared at Sylvia as she stepped into the cab as though she were a banshee. But she made no explanations, and after a glance at the steam and water gauges, climbed up to the engineer's high seat. The hand she laid upon the throttle lever trembled slightly, as well it might. The huge iron horse quivered and stiffened, as if bracing itself for its task. Noiselessly and imperceptibly it moved ahead, expelled one mighty breath, then another and another, quicker and quicker, shorter and shorter, until its respirations were lost in one continuous flow of steam. The overland was once more underway. The locomotive responded to Sylvia's touch with an alacrity which seemed almost human, and which, familiar as though she was with the work, thrilled her through and through. She glanced at the timetable. They were 12 minutes behind time. The 20 miles between the junction and Grafton lay in a straight, level line. Sylvia determined to use it to good purpose and to harden herself at once, as indeed she must, to the dizzy speed required by the inexorable schedule. She threw the throttle wide open and pushed the reverse lever into the last notch. The great machine seemed suddenly animated with a demonic energy, and soon they were shooting through the black, storm-beaten night like an avenging bolt from the hand of a colossal god. The headlight, so dazzling from in front, so insufficient from behind, danced feebly ahead upon the driving cloud of snow. That was all. The track was illuminated for scarcely 50 feet, and the night yawned beyond like some engulfing abyss. Sylvia momentarily closed her eyes and prayed that no unfortunate creature, human or brute, might wander that night between the rails. The fireman danced attendance on the fire, watching his heat and water as jealously as a doctor might watch the pulse of a fever patient. Now the furnace door was closed, now it hung on its latch, now it was closed again, and now, when the ravenous maw within cried for more coal, it was flung wide open, lighting the driving cloud of steam and smoke above with a spectral glare. Sylvia worked with the fireman with a fine intelligence which only the initiated could understand, for an engine is a steed whose speed depends upon its driver. She opened or closed the injector to economize heat and water and ease the steam when it could be spared. Thus, together, they coaxed, cajoled, threatened, and goaded the wheeled monster until, like a veritable thing of life, it seemed to strain every nerve to do their bidding and whirled them faster and faster. Yet, as they flashed through Grafton, scarcely distinguishable in the darkness and the storm, they were still 10 minutes behind time. Sylvia shut her lips tightly. If it was necessary to defy death on the curves and grades ahead, defy death she would. Sticky snow on her glass now cut off Sylvia's vision ahead. It mattered little, for her life and the lives of the sleeping passengers behind were in higher hands than hers, and only the all-seeing eye could see that night. Another train ahead, an open switch, a fallen rock or tree, one awful crash, and the engine would become a gridiron for her tender flesh, while the palatial cars behind, now so full of warmth and light and comfort, would suddenly be turned into mere shapeless heaps of death. And Sylvia cautiously opened her door a little, held it firmly against the hurricane while she brushed off the snow. At the same time, she noticed that the headlight was burning dim.
The headlight's covered with snow,
she called to the fireman. The young fellow instantly drew his cap tighter, braced himself, and swung open his door. At the first cruel blast, the speed of which was that of the gale added to that of the train, he closed his eyes and held his breath. Then, taking his life in his hands, he slipped out upon the wet, treacherous running board of the pitching locomotive, made his way forward, cleared the glass. Sylvia waited with bated breath until his head appeared in the door again.
Fire up, please,
she exclaimed nervously, for the steam had fallen off a pound. As the twinkling street lamps of Nancyville came into view, Sylvia blew the long blast. But there was no tuneful reverberation among the hills that night, for the wind, like some ferocious beast of prey, pounced upon the sound and throttled it in the teeth of the whistle. The foxes shopped in Nancyville. They could shop 50 miles from home as easily as 50 rods. And the town, by comparison with Valley Junction, was beginning to seem like a little city to Sylvia. But tonight, sitting at the helm of that transcontinental train, which burst upon the town like a cyclone with a shriek and a roar and then was gone all again in a breath, she scarcely recognized the place. It seemed little and rural and mean to her, a mere eddy in the world's great current. One third of the 149 miles was now gone, and still the overland was 10 minutes behind, and it seemed as if no human power could make up the time. They were winding through the Tallulah Hills, where the road was as crooked as a serpent's trail. The engine jerked viciously from side to side, as if angrily resenting the pitiless goading from behind, and twice Sylvia was nearly thrown from her seat. The wheels savagely ground the rails at every curve, and it made them shriek in agony. One side of the engine first mounted upward like a ship upon a wave, then suddenly sank, as if engulfed. One instant Sylvia was lifted high above her fireman, the next dropped far below him. Yet she dared not slacken speed. The cry of time, time, time was dinned into her ears with every stroke of the piston. Her train was but one wheel, nay, but one cog of one wheel, in the vast and complicated machine of transportation. Yet one slip of that cog would rudely jar the whole delicate mechanism from coast to coast. Indeed, In Sylvia's excited fancy, the spirit of worldwide commercialism seemed riding on the gale above her, like Odin of old in the Wild Hunt, urging her on and on. Something of all this was in the mind of the fireman, too, in a simpler way. And when he glanced at his gentle superior from time to time, as she clung desperately to the armrest with one hand and clutched the reverse lever with the other, with white, set face, but firm mouth and fearless eye, his blue eyes flashed with a chivalric fire. The train dashed into Carbondale. Sylvia made out ahead the glowing headlight of the eastbound train, sidetracked and waiting for the belated overland, her engineering conductor, doubtless, fuming and fretting. The first time during the run, Sylvia allowed a morbid, nervous fear to take hold of her.
Suppose the switch were open?
She knew that it must be closed, but the sickening possibility presented itself over and over again, with its train of horrors in the brief space of a few seconds. She held her breath and half closed her eyes as they thundered down upon the other train. And when the engine lurched a little as it struck the switch, her heart leaped into her mouth. The suspense was mercifully short, though, for in an instant, as it were, they were past the danger, past the town, and once more scouring the open country. In spite of the half-pipe of sand which she let run as they climbed Beechtree Hill, the last of the Tallulahs, it seemed to Sylvia as if they would never reach the summit, and as if the locomotive had lost all its vim. Yet the speed was slow only by contrast, and in reality was terrific, and the tireless steed upon whose high haunch Sylvia was perched was doing the noblest work of the night. At last, though, the high level of the barren plains was gained, and for 40 miles, which were reeled off in less than 30 minutes, they swept along like an albatross on the crest of a gale, smoothly and almost noiselessly, deadening soon. Sylvia suspected that the engine was doing no better right here than it did every night of the year, and that went on time. Yet when she glanced from the timetable to the clock, as they clicked over the switch points of Melrose with a force which seemed sufficient to snap them off like icicles, she was chagrined to discover that they were still 8 minutes behind. They were now approaching the long 12-mile descent of Four Mile Creek, with a beautiful level stretch at the bottom through the Spirit River Valley. Sylvia came to a grim determination. Half a dozen times previously, she had wondered, in her unfamiliarity with heavy trains and their magnificent speed, as if she were falling short of or exceeding the safety limit. Half a dozen times she had been on the point of appealing to the fireman. But her pride, even in that momentous crisis, had restrained her, and moreover, the timetable, mutely urging her faster and faster, seemed answer enough. But just before they struck the grade, the responsibility of her determination, contrary too to her husband's advice, seemed too much to bear alone.
"I'm going to let her have her head!"
she cried out in her distress. The fireman did not answer. Perhaps he did not hear. And setting her teeth, Sylvia assumed the grim burden alone. The ponderous locomotive fell over the brow of the hill, with her throttle agape, and the fire seething in her vitals with volcanic fury. Then she lowered her head like a maddened bull in its charge. The long, heavy train, sweeping down the sharp descent, might fitly have been likened to some winged dragon flying low to earth, so appallingly flight-like was the motion. It seemed to Sylvia as though they dropped down the grade as an aerolite drops from heaven, silent, irresistible, awful, touched only by the circumambient air. All Sylvia's familiar methods of gauging speed were now at fault, for she believed that for the moment they were running 2 miles to every minute. The thought that a puny human hand, a woman's hand, could stay that grand momentum seemed wildly absurd, and as Sylvia, under the strange lassitude born of her deadly peril, relaxed her tense muscles and drowsily closed her eyes, she smiled with a ghastly humor at the trust of the sleeping passengers in her. She was rudely shaken out of her lethargy as the train struck a slight curve halfway down the grade. The locomotive shied like a frightened steed and shook in every iron muscle. The flanges shrieked against the rails, the cab swayed and cracked, and the very earth seemed to tremble. For a moment, the startled girl was sure that they were upon the ties or had at least lost a wheel. But it was only the terrible momentum lifting them momentarily from the track, and in a few seconds, though every second meant 150 feet, the fire-eating behemoth righted itself. Yet its beautiful equilibrium was gone, and as if abandoning itself to its driver's mad mood, the engine rolled and pitched and rose and fell like a waterlogged vessel in a storm. The bell, catching upon the motion, began to toll, and the dolorous sound, twisted into weird discord by the gale, fell upon the ears of the pallid engineer and fireman like the notes of a storm-tossed bellboy, sounding the knell of the doomed. The young fireman, who up to this time had maintained a stoical calm, suddenly sprang to the floor of the cab, with a face torn by superstitious fear.
"What if she leaves the rails?"
he cried. But instantly recovering himself, he sprang back to his seat with the blood of shame on his cheeks.
"Am I running too fast?
No one were behind time!"
he doggedly shouted back. As the train became smoother, the engine grew calmer, but its barred tongue licking up the flying space for many a minute before the momentum of that perilous descent was lost. As the roar of their passage over the long bridge spanning the Matunk, 20 miles from Stockton, died away, the fireman called out cheerily,
"On time, madam!"
His voice reached Sylvia's swimming ears faint and distant as she nodded dizzily on her seat, bracing herself against the reverse lever. Meanwhile, in the general superintendent's private car, at the extreme rear of the train, a party of men still sat up, smoking their Havanas and sipping their wine. One member of this party was the big gun mentioned to Sylvia by the general superintendent, the president of the Mississippi Valley, Oahu, and Western Railway. He was a large man with luxuriant snow-white hair, and though his face was benevolent, even paternal, every line of it betrayed the inflexible will which had lifted its owner from the roof of a freight car to the presidential chair of a great road. Mr. Howard, the general superintendent, was regaling the party with an account of his experience in securing a substitute engineer at Valley Junction. For reasons afterwards divulged, he suppressed, though, the most startling feature of his story, namely the sex of the engine runner he had secured. But he compensated his hearers for this omission with a most dramatic account of the heroism of the sick man, whom he unblushingly represented as having risen from his bed and taken charge of the engine. Mr. Staniford, the distinguished guest, listened quietly until Howard was done.
"Charlie, you are a heartless wretch,"
he observed, smiling. And when Howard protested, with a twinkle in his eye, that there was no other way, the president added,
"If it had been on my road, I should have held the train all night rather than drag a sick man from his bed."
"We all know how many trains are held all night on your road, Staniford. Do you happen to remember the story of an ambitious young engineer who picked himself up out of a wreck with a broken arm and stepped into a new engine and pulled his train through to the end of the run?"
"I was young then and working for glory. No superintendent ordered me to do it, or I should probably have refused. These engineers are a heroic set. Charlie, I sometimes think we don't always do them justice."
"I'll do this one justice."
The party dropped off to bed, one by one. The general superintendent himself finally rose and looked at his watch. As he turned and made his way forward, his careless expression gave way to one of concern. His mind was evidently on the gentle engine runner. Possibly he had recurring doubts of her skill and courage, but perhaps the fact that he had daughters of his own gave his thought, as much as anything else, a graver turn. 3 cars ahead, he met the conductor, who also seemed a little nervous, and they talked together for some moments. The train, at the time, was snapping around the choppy curves in the Tallulah Hills like the flash of a whip, and the two men had difficulty keeping their feet.
"Fast, but not too fast, Dawkins.
What I call a high safety.
But fearful in the cab, eh?"
"Nothing equal to it, sir."
Howard started back toward the private car about the time the train struck Beechtree Hill. He paused in a vestibule, opened the door, and laid his practiced ear to the din outside. Then he gently closed the door, as if to slam it might break the spell, and complacently smiled. When the train reached the level of barren plains, and the sleepers ceased their swaying and settled down to a smooth, straightaway motion, that sure annunciator of high speed, the superintendent rubbed his palms together, very much like a man shaking hands with himself. When he got back to his car, he found Mr. Staniford still up, smoking, and leaning back in the luxurious seat with half-closed eyes. Staniford motioned Howard to sit down beside him and laid his hand familiarly on the latter's knee.
"Confound you, Charlie. You've got that sick engineer on my heart now. With your inflammatory descriptions, for which you probably drew largely on your imagination, I've been sitting here thinking about him now. Confess, you exaggerated matters a little."
"Well, I did in one respect, but in another, I fell short. Staniford, I've got the best railroad story to give the papers that has been brought out in years, and if I don't get several thousand dollars worth of free advertising out of it, my name isn't C.W. Howard. And the best of it, it's the gospel truth."
"Well, let's have it."
"Well, between you and me, that man Fox was a mighty sick man."
"Wait a minute. Did you say Fox?"
"Yes."
"What's his first name?"
"I don't know. He's a tall, smooth-faced fella with dark hair and eyes. Rather intelligent looking. What do you know about him? He's a comparatively new man with us.
I don't know that I know him, but if he's the man I have in mind, he's all right. Go on.
He ever run on your road?
Yes, yes. That's got nothing to do with it. Just go on.
Well, he was altogether too sick to pull a plug, but it seems that his wife was been in the habit of riding with him and knows the road and an engine as well as he does. And to come to the point, and this is my story, which I didn't tell the boys for the sake of their nerves, the Overland at this moment is in the hands of a girl, sir, Fox's wife.
It seemed a long time before either man spoke again. Howard stared in blank amazement at the pallid face of the president, unable to understand the old railroader's agitation and unwilling to attribute it to fear of being in the hands of an engineer who might lose her head. Then Staniford took the other's hand and held it in an iron grip.
Charlie, it's my own little baby girl.
Howard was familiar with the story of the elopement of Staniford's daughter with one of the M, V, O, and W engineers, and the situation flashed over him in an instant. After a moment, during which, as he afterwards confessed, he could not keep his mind off the added sensation this new fact would give his advertising story, he said enthusiastically,
"She's a heroine, Staniford, and worthy of her father."
During the perilous descent of Four Mile Creek, the private car rocked like a cradle, cracked and snapped in every point. Staniford hung helplessly to Howard's hands, with the tears trickling down his cheeks. When the bottom was at last reached and the danger was over, the danger at the front, the president drew his handkerchief and wiped the great drops of sweat from his brow. The ex-engineer knew the agony through which his child had passed. The operator at Valley Junction had flashed the news along the wire, and when the Overland steamed up to the Union Depot in Stockton at 1:07, 20 seconds ahead of time, a curious and enthusiastic throng of layover passengers and railroad men pressed around the engine. When Sylvia appeared in the gangway, her glorious sun-kissed hair glistening with melted snow and her pale face streaked with soot, the generous crowd burst into yells of applause. The husky old veteran runner who was to take the girl's place stepped forward by virtue of his office, as it were, and lifted Sylvia down. For a moment she reeled, partly from faintness, partly from the sickness caused by the pitching of the locomotive. Then she saw, pushing unceremoniously through the throng, the general superintendent and, she started and looked again, her father. When President Staniford, struggling to control his emotion, clasped his daughter to his bosom, her overstrained nerves gave way under the double excitement, and laying her head wearily upon his shoulder, and with her hands upon his neck, she began to cry in a choked, pitiful little way.
Oh, Papa, call me your dear little redhead once more.
Listening to The Night Run of the Overland. In our cast, we had the lovely and talented Abergene Plum, Payne's Gray, Woody Creek, Van Dyke Brown, and Fortunato. The story was The Night Run of the Overland by Elmore Elliott Peak. This has been Gremlin Time. Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. You're listening to your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha Cha Club.
Ole, ole, it's go time!
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing word and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd feed the audience too.
All together in the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing word and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Bird of paradise is an elegant bird. It likes to be seen and it loves to be heard. Most little birdies will fly away, but the tiki room birds are here every day.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
a little louder.
In the tiki 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 room, all the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In the tiki tiki
taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. This is the Tiki Cha Cha Club, where the cocktail nation meets exotica at the corner of Kalakaua Boulevard and Bourbon Street in a little Spanish village, a small discotheque on the Isle of Capri.
Yeah.